Hello, my name is Dave Emery, and this is Sod 1 of For the Record program number 612, titled Miscellaneous Articles and Updates. This is being recorded on September 30th of the year 2007. Now, as the broadcast indicates, as the title of the broadcast indicates, we're going to be either introducing and or updating a number of different stories, either covered here for the first time or, in most cases, covered in one way or another before. Now, I want to encourage members of the listening audience to take advantage of the vast amount of information available on the Spitfire website at www.spitfirelist.com and the vast amount of linked information as well on other websites. There is just a huge sort of an anti-fascist cornucopia available at www.spitfirelist.com and a linked website. So please do use that, and I think increasingly an intelligent, judicious use of that website will become, if not essential, certainly greatly beneficial, already greatly beneficiary, but perhaps even essential to a real understanding of the For the Record programs. Now, we're going to begin by taking a look not only at an event that took place this past week, garnered a lot of commentary and generated a lot of adrenaline, accurately so, in my opinion, but in the op-ed column about the appearance of President Ahmadinejad of Iran at Columbia University this past week, there is discussion of not only the past appearance of the Nazi ambassador to the United States, Hans Luther, in 1933, but also a number of steps taken by the pro-fascist president of Columbia University to cement ties not only between Columbia and the university structure of fascist Italy, which was under the governance of the fascist government. It was a totalitarian dictatorial system, and the educational system most assuredly was not allowed to proceed in an unsupervised fashion, to put it mildly. And also Luther sought, and to a certain extent achieved, a similar degree of cooperation and coordination with university elements in Nazi Germany. And again, those elements, too, firmly under the domination of the Nazi regime. We're going to be also, I think, examining some comments that are spot on among the many real tragedies of the just ongoing farce and the bloody, horrendous farce that is taking place in Iraq, is the fact that Bush obviously has engaged in the most heinous sort of misrepresentation in order to get us into the war. And as touched on this past week in a Spanish investigative piece, Bush basically was talking with foreign leaders and saying in no uncertain terms, back us, because we're going into Iraq, whether Saddam Hussein permits further inspections on top of what he's done already, as we're demanding, or as we say we're demanding, because the waters are awfully muddied in that regard. Basically, one of the tragedies of the fact that the Bush administration behaved in that fashion, with the just cataclysmic results that have come out of that not necessarily an awful lot of people in power in this country, but certainly for people in Iraq and for the American fighting personnel who are there, and for America's reputation and for the military as a whole. Because now, when there really is a threat from somebody who's developing weapons of mass destruction, his elaborate disclaimers to the contrary notwithstanding, we are really not in a position to do anything about it. It's also worth noting, too, aside from, I think, some very important comments by this fellow, that now we have a threat that we should be doing something about of one kind or another, if destabilization, if not outright military action, certainly diplomatic pressure and economic pressure, which would be much more effective if we had any credibility and had behaved with integrity, which unfortunately we have not. Our administration has not. But what is touched on here in discussion of Columbia University, there really is not a great deal of background discussion here, but fascism is not an aberration. Sort of the standard viewpoint of World War II is that basically there were a few lone nuts, one of them Hitler, a ranter and raver with a toothbrush mustache, who hypnotized all the Germans and made them all go crazy. And then there was a big war, and the Japanese had an emperor that they worshipped, and so they did the same thing. And Mussolini did the same thing to the Italian people, and that's why World War II happened. It's sort of a lone nut version. Hitler was the lone nut who made World War II happen. Now, in fact, some very powerful elements, and elements that were viewed with great prestige, elements that were very much in the mainstream, were associated with or active promoters of fascism, and saw to it that it not only was able to do a lot of what it sought to do, but that it was represented in a very favorable way even after it became clear that this was a brutal system. Anyway, talking about, among other things, a very real threat, whether or not it's met, and also about the very real, or at least a tiny bit, of the real history of fascism, there's the following op-ed column from the LA Times of September 29th of 2007. It's by Tim Rutten, or Tim Rutten, R-U-T-T-E-N, I'm not sure how it's pronounced, an LA Times columnist. It's headlined, or titled, Ahmadinejad Walks Away with a Win. It reads, one of the world's truly dangerous men, Iranian President Mahmoud Ahmadinejad, left New York a clear winner this week, and he can thank the arrogance of the American Academy and most of the U.S. news media's studied indifference for his victory. If the blood-drenched history of the century just passed had taught American academics one thing, it should have been that the totalitarian impulse knows no accommodation with reason. You cannot change the totalitarian mind through dialogue or a conversation, because totalitarianism, however ingenious the superstructure of faux ideas with which it surrounds itself, is a creature of the will and not the mind. That's a large lesson, but what should have made Ahmadinejad's appearance at Columbia University this week a wholly avoidable debacle was the school's knowledge of its own very specific history. In the 1930s, Columbia was run by Nicholas Murray Butler, to whose name a special sort of infamy attaches. Butler was an outspoken admirer of Italian fascism and its leader, Benito Mussolini. The Columbia president, who also was in the forefront of Ivy League efforts to restrict Jewish enrollment, worked tirelessly to build ties between his school and Italian universities, as well as with the powerful fascist student organizations. At one point, a visiting delegation of 350 ardent young black shirts serenaded Butler with the fascist anthem. Butler also was keen to establish connections with Nazi Germany and its universities. In 1933, he invited Hans Luther, L-U-T-H-E-R, Adolf Hitler's ambassador to the United States, to lecture on the Columbia campus. Luther stressed Hitler's peaceful intentions, unquote, toward his European neighbors, and afterward, Butler gave a reception in his honor. As the emissary of a friendly people, unquote, Luther was entitled to be received with the greatest courtesy and respect, unquote, the Columbia president said at the time. It was such a transparently appalling performance all around that one of the anonymous authors of the New York Times' Topics of the Times, unquote, column put tongue-in-cheek and looked forward to the occasion when the Nazi leaders will point out that they were all along opposed to any measures capable of being construed as unjust to any element of the German population or as a threat to peace in Europe, unquote. Arrogance, though, is invincible even to irony. 3 years later, Butler sent a delegation of Columbia dignitaries to participate in anniversary celebrations at the University of Heidelberg. That was after Heidelberg had purged all the Jewish professors from its faculty, reformed its curriculum according to Nazi educational theories, and publicly burned the unapproved books in its libraries. It would be interesting to know if any consideration of these events and all that followed a decade of engagement and dialogue with fascism occurred before Columbia extended a speaking invitation to a man who hopes to see Israel, quote, wiped off the face of the earth, unquote, has denied the Holocaust, and is defying the world community in pursuit of nuclear weapons. Perhaps they did. And perhaps that's part of what motivated Lee Bollinger, Columbia's president now, to deliver his extraordinarily ill-advised welcoming remarks to Ahmadinejad. Bollinger clearly had an American audience in mind when he denounced the Iranian leader to his face as a cruel and petty dictator and described his Holocaust denial as designed to, quote, fool the illiterate and the ignorant, unquote. Bollinger's remarks may have taken him off the hook with his domestic critics, but when it came to the international media audience that really counted, Ahmadinejad already had carried the day. The invitation to speak at Columbia already had given him something totalitarian demagogues, who were as image-conscious as Hollywood stars, always crave: legitimacy. Bollinger's denunciation was icing on the cake because the constituency the Iranian leader cares about is scattered across an Islamic world that values hospitality and its courtesies as core social virtues. To that audience, Butler looked stunningly ill-mannered, Ahmadinejad dignified and restrained. Back in Tehran, Mohsen Mirdamadi, a leading Iranian reformer and Ahmadinejad opponent, said Bollinger's blistering remarks, quote, only strengthened, unquote, the president back home and made his radical supporters more determined, unquote. According to an Associated Press report, many Iranians found the comments insulting, particularly because in Iranian traditions of hospitality, a host should be polite to a guest no matter what he thinks of him. To many, Ahmadinejad looked like the victim, and hardliners praised the president's calm demeanor during the event, saying Bollinger was spouting a, quote, Zionist line, unquote. All of this was bad enough, but the almost willful refusal of commentators in the American media to provide their audiences with insights into just how sinister Ahmadinejad really is compounded the problem. There are a couple of reasons for the media's general refusal to engage with radical Islamic revivalists like Ahmadinejad. He belongs to a particularly aggressive school of radical Shiite Islamism, the Haghani, which lives in expectation of an imminent coming of the Mahdi, a kind of Islamic Messiah who will bring peace and justice, along with universal Islamic rule to the entire world. Serious members of this school, and Ahmadinejad, who was a brilliant university student, is a very serious member, believe they must act to speed the Mahdi's coming. The wave of the Islamic Revolution, unquote, would soon reach the entire world, he has promised. The president, as a fundamentally secular institution, the American press always has had a hard time coming to grips with the fact that Islamists like the Iranian president mean what they say and that they really do believe what they say they believe. Finally, there's the fact that the neoconservative remnants clustered around Vice President Dick Cheney are beating the drums for a preemptive military action against Iran before it becomes a nuclear nation, as North Korea already has, thereby constraining U.S. policy in Northwest Asia. After being duped by the Bush administration into helping pave the way for the disastrous war in Iraq, few in the American media now are willing to take the Iran problem on because they don't want to be complicit in another military misadventure. Fair enough, but that anxiety doesn't exempt the press from being realistic about who Ahmadinejad really is and the danger he really poses to all around him. Indeed, and one of the things that is unfortunate about the failure to really investigate September 11th and related matters, to do a really good job of examining the forces that actually brought that about, is that at the operational level, one finds cooperation between neo-Nazi and neo-fascist elements and Islamist elements. And one of the things that did not get a great deal of publicity was the fact, although certainly at the Iranian Holocaust Denial Conference in December of 2006, the presence of people like David Duke got a fair amount of publicity. But one of the things that was mentioned was that the circle of advisors and associates around Ahmadinejad were networking with European neo-Nazi groups. And even if the current regime in Iran doesn't develop nuclear weapons, they obviously have nuclear materials, and whether or not they develop nuclear weapons and or if they just give some nuclear materials to some of these European neo-Nazi groups, That there, in and of itself, is a blueprint for some serious, serious nastiness. And as I noted at the time, noting that the Iran is developing a nuclear capability, that there are documented links between the Iranian regime and terrorist elements around the world, including perhaps most fascinatingly links between the Iranian regime, its proxy Hezbollah, and Europe and various fascist elements in Argentina in the AMIA bombing, and aiding those elements were some American neo-Nazi and neo-fascist elements as well, with whom they were apparently networked. Talked about that in For the Record 456, among other broadcasts. So, as I noted when the Iranian Holocaust Denial Conference was going on, Dukes, meaning David Duke, Dukes and Nukes are a really bad combination. And mixing nuclear technology with European neo-Nazi groups and Islamists, some of whom feel they have to hasten their version of the end times, doesn't sound very appealing to me. And with end times philosophers among some of the Christians grouped around George Bush, that's an interesting prospect as well. But one of the things to take note of in that particular column was the degree of favor with which Nazi Germany and fascist Italy, and to a lesser extent Imperial Japan, were viewed by the power elites of this world. Their economic and political doctrines and the fact that they were active anti-communist military powers, in some cases right on the borders or virtually on the borders of the Soviet Union, that won them great esteem in the eyes of some very powerful elements and very influential people, including the former president of Columbia University. Indeed, the Nazi racial laws themselves had some very strong influence by world eugenics thinking and American eugenics thinking in particular. Good discussion of that in, among other books, The Nazi Connection by Stefan Kuhl, published in hardcover by the Oxford University Press, and also the book by Edwin Black called The War Against the Weak. I believe it's Four Walls, Four Windows Press published that one, but both of them very good books about the American/German eugenics connection and the significant influence of elements of American academia on the formation and the crafting of the Nazi racial laws that led to their exterminations. The point being that the horrors of World War II weren't produced by a lone nut. Neither, by the way, were the horrors of November 22, 1963 in Dealey Plaza. Interesting article about that. It doesn't really say a whole lot, but continuously, or not continuously, far from it, but periodically little burps take place which cast at least a little doubt on the official version of the assassination of President Kennedy, but in fact, they don't go nearly as far as they should. Bottom line, the assassination of President Kennedy was a coup d'etat. Some very powerful fascist elements in this country seized power from the lawful authority themselves, and a great many very bad things have resulted from that. It was not a lone nut, any more than World War II was produced by a lone nut. First, this particular story questioning the methodology and the scientific validity of the core theory, namely the single bullet theory, which is alleged to prove that Lee Harvey Oswald could not, or rather was, the lone assassin of President Kennedy. In fact, he was a patsy. From the San Francisco Chronicle of Saturday, May 26th of 2007, an AP story datelined Houston, and it's authored by Juan Lozano, headlined Questions on Killing of JFK, subheaded New Study of Bullets Finds Room to Doubt Single Shooter Theory. It reads in part, new testing on the type of ammunition used in the 1963 assassination of President John F. Kennedy raises questions about whether Lee Harvey Oswald acted alone, according to a study by researchers at Texas A&M University. Lead researcher Cliff Spiegelman stressed, however, that the findings do not necessarily support conspiracy theorists who for decades have doubted Oswald was the lone gunman. Quote, we're not saying there was a conspiracy. All we're saying is the evidence that was presented as a slam dunk for a single shooter is not a slam dunk, unquote, said Spiegelman, a Texas A&M statistics professor and an expert in bullet lead analysis. The Warren Commission concluded in 1964 that Oswald fired three shots at Kennedy's motorcade from the Texas School Book Depository in Dallas. The U.S. House Select Committee on Assassinations agreed in 1979 and found that the two bullets that hit Kennedy came from Oswald's rifle. But the House Select Committee on Assassinations found that there was a conspiracy and also basically endorsed the findings of Jim Garrison's investigation in New Orleans, although that didn't get a lot of publicity, and we continue to see spin in another direction. Continuing with the article. The committee's findings were based in part on the testimony of the late forensic chemist Vincent Ginn, who said recovered fragments came from only two bullets. Ginn testified that the bullets Oswald used, Western Winchester Cartridge Company Mannlicher Carcano bullets, were unique and that it would be possible to distinguish one from another even if they both came from the same box. But Spiegelman and his fellow researchers, who tested 30 of the same type of bullets, found that fragments were not nearly so rare and that the bullets within the same box could match one another. One of the test bullets also matched one or more of the assassination fragments. Quote, this finding means that the bullet fragments from the assassination that match could have come from three or more separate bullets, unquote. The researchers wrote in a paper detailing their study to be published by the Journal Annals of Applied Statistics. The study is available on the journal's website. Quote, if the assassination fragments are derived from three or more separate bullets, then a second assassin is likely, as the additional bullet would not be attributable to the main suspect, Mr. Oswald, unquote, they wrote. I'm not doubting necessarily what they're saying here, far from it, but the fact of the matter is that although, and I'm not accusing and not implying they're acting in bad faith, but the official version of the assassination of President Kennedy is quite simply a farce, and there's an abundance of evidence in that regard. And most importantly at this point is to, once one does acquire a familiarity with the fact that the official version is incorrect, I think it's important, once one has acquired something of a familiarity with the actual facts as they occurred, to get off the grassy knoll, grasp the political implications of that important event, and move on. And in fact, one of the things that one needs to grasp as a result of a study of the Kennedy assassination is that political murder is a way of life in the United States. And so when one sees a story like the following, one wants to ask questions. What's going on here? What might have been the motive for the following act? This is an Associated Press story, and it's an AP story, datelined August 24th of 2007. It's from Orlando, Florida, and it's headlined, GOP Consultant and Two Men Found Dead in Florida. A Republican political consultant and two other men were found dead in a home in an apparent double murder and suicide, authorities and relatives said. Authorities have not determined a motive for the deaths of Ralph Gonzalez, his roommate David Abrami, 36, and a friend Robert Drake, 30. Investigators found weapons and signs of a struggle in the house, but they did not say what the weapons were or which man they believe was the killer. The men are believed to have died several days before the bodies were discovered Thursday. Gonzalez was executive director of the Georgia Republican Party from 2001 to 2002. He managed U.S. Representative Tom Feeney's 2002 campaign and was president of Strategem Group, an Orlando-based political consulting firm that represents Republican candidates. Skipping down, Gonzalez, the son of Cuban immigrants, was devoted to politics even as a youth, said his father Rafael Gonzalez of Miami. And skipping down still further, he was a smart person who built a business all by himself, Rafael Gonzalez said. He traveled all over the world. Abrami, an attorney, was active in Republican politics as well. And so one wants to ask a question when you see a story like that. Who did them and why? What might this be connected to? And among other broadcasts, our discussions with Daniel Hopsicker, we've taken a look at some of the interesting things going on in Florida. And let's just say an awful lot of people died in Florida, including Gus Bulis, a friend of George Bush. And there are an awful lot of shenanigans going on vis-a-vis Republican and other kinds of politics in Florida. So again, when one comes across stories that are about the demise of the prominent. You want to make sure you know what your is really going on in the world before one simply brushes some of these off as happenstance. So I do think that looking at stories both inside and outside of the United States with a knowing eye, you don't want to get too paranoid because there are some people who are inclined to do that. But nevertheless, when you see stories like the following, tragic end for Blair's chum Nico. This is from August 20th of 2007 from the Daily Mail in the United Kingdom. A wealthy banking friend of Tony Blair has died following a freak accident at his fabulous French chateau where he entertained the former prime minister and his wife, Cherie. Multimillionaire Nicholas Lethbridge, known as Nico, fell 2 weeks ago from a landing at the house in southern France he had lovingly restored. He died 8 days later in the hospital. The tragedy has stunned friends of Lethbridge, 58, who worked for the World Bank and investment firm Babcock & Brown before quitting the rat race to spend time with his wife Rachel and their children Josephine, 16, and Max, 12. And skipping down. But Labour supporting Lethbridge, who divided his time between France and a period family house in Greenwich, South London, later became disenchanted with his friend Tony Blair over the war in Iraq. It is believed he fell after getting up early to make himself a cup of coffee and tragically crashing through the balustrade and down a stairwell. By the way, he also worked for, among other companies, the British branch of the Schroeder Banking melange, which, among other things, was involved with the financing of fascism in World War II. So the very interesting late Mr. Nicholas Lethbridge, a friend of Tony Blair's and an ally of Tony Blair's until he turned against Blair's stance on the Iraq War, was fixing himself a cup of coffee and just crashed through the balustrade at this lavish French chateau that he was restoring, and fell to his demise. So long, Nico. Again, one wonders whether there's more to that story than we have been told. But one must always ask for whom the bell tolls, because it may not be tolling for thee right now, but stick around, and who knows what might happen. That concludes Side 1 of For the Record Program Number 612, Miscellaneous Articles and Updates, being recorded on September 30th of the year 2007. My name's Dave Emery. Thanks for listening.